Hey buddy, how is it going? So, for example, if I want to build like 1 kilowatt of a device, where does the extra energy come from? Do you think it comes from the ground? Because like two or three coils cannot produce 1 kV of energy with a little bit of input. That extra energy must come from somewhere. Do you think that the earth ground is a
Yes,
possibility?
the earth is a
Thank you.
possibility. Nearby house wire or transmission wires are also another possibility, but and those are the most likely if they are available because they tend to be more dense in energy, and these circuits that I use are reactive pumps, just like a heat pump moves heat around using very little energy. These circuits use reactants to move energy around, and if there's energy available in the man-made environment, which tends to be more dense than in nature, then the reactive pump circuit will avail itself of the available supplies of energy before it does the last-ditch effort, which is to react off of reactants. This is something that I suspect, and I believe, if I understand correctly, is not understood by electrical engineers at all. They just assume that conservation applies to everything, including reactants, in which reactants has to be converted from real power as if reactants was reactive power, which it is not. It's not a version of power. It's not even the storage of power. See, this is the problem. We term reactants as the storage of power in capacitors and inductors, and it's temporary, and eventually it has to come back out again as power. And it doesn't work that way all the time. In fact, it doesn't work that way at all. What happens is because we overfeed our circuits' voltage more than what they need to cover their load, because we think we're covering not only the load but losses as well. This suppresses the overreactance phenomenon that I see occur in a circuit that rings with overunity, in which the reactance keeps building up its amplitude, its VARs keeps building up greater than what happened initially. And it's literally reacting off of reactants at that point and is no longer tied to the input of real power. Now, I finally got a admission of this from an electrical engineer, a car mechanic, actually, of all things, who is probably near retirement. He's been in the business for so long. And he unfortunately got very emotional. And I think he's scared stiff that I don't buckle down and conform readily. I don't know what he's afraid of. But I've seen this happen before, that people get terrified of what I'm presenting to them. And I think it's because I hit a nerve. Well, in his case, he could not focus. He just kept going on and on and on about what he was taught. And that's fine and dandy, but doesn't concern me because it's not relevant. So what I eventually found him, and he agreed with his error, was that he kept talking about AC systems, and I had to remind him, hey, look, this is not an AC system that I endeavor to produce. It may start out that way because I'm feeding it an AC circuit, but sometimes, I have a circuit, I don't feed it AC, I feed it DC, and it creates AC within itself because it bounces back and forth between two capacitors across an inductor. So it's not, but in any case, I am feeding it AC at this point, this particular circuit, and I showed him a picture in which it is from another circuit that's similar, or that's the same one, just a different variation. I can't remember, but it was done some time ago, and I put it up on Stack Exchange. And it's an AC input, but the AC begins to exhibit characteristics of a parasitic triangular wave formation that rides piggyback on top of the AC sine wave, and the triangular piggyback parasite grows in amplitude and eventually dwarfs the AC sine wave that it rides on top of. And it keeps growing in amplitude. It doesn't stop. So that was a version of a circuit that did not pulse very nicely and maintain itself. It just grew to infinite oblivion. But it literally depends on the AC sine wave. I've tried, you know, giving the circuit other sine wave or other types of waves, like triangle waves or square waves. It doesn't work. It has to either create a sine wave oscillation inside of itself or be fed one from outside itself. And the triangle waves are not really triangle waves. They're explosive waves because the energy disappears in between the peaks and troughs of the so-called triangle wave. It literally disappears for the entire triangular cycle that's riding on top of the sine wave cycle. And of course, the triangle wave cycle is at a higher frequency than the sine wave cycle in order to ride piggyback on top of it. At this point, the circuit I'm working on, I feed it a 30,000 cycle per second sine wave and 150,000 cycles per second triangle, so or spike waves or explosive waves, is manifesting in its place. In any case, the voltage and the current are out of phase by 180 degrees, and they only appear each half cycle for an instant. There are no data points. The simulator doesn't produce any data points in between each half cycle. So the energy, or this reactance, literally disappears for most of the cycle and only appears once every half cycle, and it switches places. So when the amps reach maximum, the voltage is reaching minimum at the same time, and then vice versa at the next half cycle. But only for an instant, and that instant is what, a quantum of duration? I don't even know what it is, because it always is just that. It's just an instant, regardless of any other consideration. So, I don't know, now I'm losing track of my line of reasoning or what I was saying before I got to this point, but so I got him to concede because he said, oh, well, you're running it at your AC sine wave at 2 million cycles. That was the example from Stack Exchange from many years ago, but I was running it at 2 million, and I guess he was paying attention. I wasn't. And he said, well, of course it's going to do the stuff you say it does, ring with overunity, because that's why we don't run our AC systems at that high frequency, because we'd get the same result as you do. That's why we run it at 50 or 60 cycles per second, to keep it nice and stable. Well, yeah, I have to agree. I've tried many, many different variations of this particular circuit. And I think the lowest I was able to lower the frequency of the sine wave input was something like 11 or 13,000 cycles per second and still get an overunity ringing. But below that, it goes comatose. And if I go too high, at this particular juncture, this particular variation of this type of circuit, if I go to, 100 or 1,000 cycles per second of input of sine wave, the thing literally explodes, and I lose the ability to pulse it at a nice periodic collapse to keep it from exploding. So I do have to stay within a certain window of frequency, but he did admit it. And this is the first time an electrical engineer who's, you know, conservative and upholds the apple cart of status quo, this is the first time he actually used an argument other than, oh, but you're dealing with lossless reactants, useless. They never say lossless, and I have to correct them now that I know better. But initially I did not, when they tried to pull that swingy on me. No, it's lossless, it's not useless, but now this guy is saying, yeah, it happens, but you're using too high a frequency, dude. So he's agreeing with me, yet he's promoting this ideology that I'm still doing it wrong. And I've heard this, actually, I've heard that one before. Oh, you're doing it all wrong, you know? Like, but that's the whole point, is to go against convention, because I'm not creating a transmission system. With this system, you wouldn't have to transmit energy to anyone. You produce it on site, wherever you need it. And it's not like you're getting it. Ultimately, if you cannot get it from a man-made source, and it will steal from a man-made source from nearby, if it can. But if you cannot get it from a man-made source, it'll get it from itself. It's a self-feeding phenomenon in which the reactants reacts off of itself, its own initial reactants, and it's able to do so because your input voltage is so low, you don't suppress it. You don't suppress the self-feeding positive feedback condition. Because it's lossless, it has nowhere to go but to accumulate, because it's reacting off of itself at this point. So you give it something, you have to, you give it a little bit of kick of real power. And then it reacts off of that, but then it reacts off of its reactants. And the reactants off of the reactants keeps building up in amplitude and dwarfs and overwhelms the amplitude of the input that you're giving it. And it'll grow to whatever level you want it to. It literally, the output has no causal relationship to the input. The input does not cause the output as we normally think of conservation of energy, because it has nothing to do with that. It's simply there as a stimulus to catalyze a reaction. So when you say, where does it come from? Well, at one point I was thinking, well, maybe it's coming from the energy that's stored in the valence electron shells of the atoms holding objects together. And that could be, because Tesla did various experiments in which he raised the frequency, he raised the voltage, and at some point the wire would explode into microscopic particles of copper dust. And what I understand, from having been corrected by electrical engineers or chemical engineers, that what happens is when we form objects, solid objects, and bind all the particles together, that's exothermic. So the object loses heat energy or electrical energy, whatever. It loses energy when an object is formed. But when an object explodes into dust, it actually absorbs energy from its environment. It's endothermic. And that actually is exactly according to the experience of inventors every time I've ever heard it take place, is that their circuit is absorbing heat when it runs. And the only time it would do the opposite is because it's changing, it's converting its reactants into real power because of the impedances, the positive impedances of the coils, and then they heat up and they fry themselves. But when that does not occur due to positive impedance, and when we literally have the negative impedance, we literally have an endothermic reaction. And so it shows that the circuit is absorbing energy of one sort or another. It tries to from its environment, because it's a reactive pump. And it's pumping, it's sucking energy in from its environment. And it's doing so because in order to form objects in the first place, it has to lose energy. It's exothermic when we form solid objects, and so when it's running as an overunity circuit, it literally becomes endothermic. So it'll absorb heat, electricity, whatever it can do, it'll absorb it wherever it can get it. But if it can't, it will literally get it from itself. And this, although this electrical engine, this car mechanic admitted to it, he didn't want to go there because, in fact, he keeps insisting that's wrong, you know? That's not the way you do things in a proper society. And of course you can't, because most of the time these types of circuits simply want to blow up because it becomes a runaway chain reaction in which, like a nuclear chain reaction, except this is electrical, it keeps absorbing energy from its environment and it just blows up. But if you can get it to collapse in a periodic manner, and it's kind of like a strobe light bulb because it just strobes, then it maintains itself. And because it never destroys its host, it collapses. The process of absorption from the environment collapses in a periodic manner, and so you never reach infinity, and so it never blows itself up and destroys itself. And that's the ideal condition, and it's a very tenuous one because it can easily collapse into comatose, or it can blow up if you go outside the various parameters of maintenance of that strobing effect. So if you're wondering where the energy comes from, it can come from a number of places outside the circuit, but if it can't get it from there, it'll get it from itself. It literally gets it from the initial condition you gave it. So you have to give it something. So if you're wondering, so it can either come from the environment or it comes from the initial condition that you gave it, because you always have to give it something to get it kick-started. But once it gets started, it can literally feed off of what you initially gave it, to answer your question. That's the worst case scenario of where does it get it from.
If I've done one simulation example that can only blow up, and the coupling, the magnetic coupling between the circuit and I created a kind of a man-made transmission line to see if the circuit would steal from it, and it did. And the magnetic coupling between the two was so small, there was the number of zeros to the right of the decimal point was something like 24 or something. It was humongously tiny, teeny-weeny. There was hardly any coupling there at all, and yet it stole from it nonetheless. So you don't have to say, oh, it gets it from the ground, because it does not need a direct connection. And an inductive coupling is adequate, and it doesn't have to be 100% or 99%. It doesn't have to be even 10% or 1%. It can be one part per gazillion percent. And yet it will steal from that transmission line. Now, this concurs with Sierra Lamont. 100 years ago, his circuit, he literally was charged with stealing energy from the grid and was arrested when he set foot in Washington, D.C., when he sought to get a patent, and he brought his car, his batteryless car, with him. And when he did the demonstration with his brother in the streets of Denver, Colorado, in the foothills outside Denver, surrounding downtown Denver, the lights went out. The power grid went down. So he was charged kind of correctly, but I suspect it was more complicated than that, that ultimately he was disturbing the grid. He was a domestic terrorist. He was not stealing from the grid, ultimately, and if we take a large enough view, he was probably contributing to the grid more than anything. But he was disturbing it, and that disturbance put things out of phase so that there was too much reactive power, not enough real power, and so people's power went out. Not that the power wasn't there, it's just they couldn't make use of it. And so what I let's see, what was the thought? So he told someone that his device, he literally he never plugged into it. He had his power station somewhere, is either the attic of his home or his basement. And he said it had to be within 10 miles of the receiver. And the receiver coil was an iron coil, and he put iron rebar adjacent to it and to demonstrate. And he hooked up the two terminals of that receiving coil to a little buzzer, a door buzzer, and it buzzed like crazy, and it was overfed. It had too much energy. Yet it was not connected to the power supply. So he did things differently. See, I don't try to do things that way because I don't see that he did his system before the inauguration of the FCC. The FCC was inaugurated in 1934, And he went out of business in 1921. So that was 13 years prior. So if any ham radio operators were around, they probably would have triangulated and found out, hey, this guy is disturbing the airwaves. Do something about it, FCC. And they would have raided his place, and that would have been the end of him. But they didn't exist yet. So he was actually on purpose transmitting power to his appliances up to 10 miles radius. And that's okay if you're not trying to get power from the grid, because if you are, it probably obliterates that condition, that stable condition of 60 cycles or whatever it happens to be, because he's running at a different frequency and his phase relations are all different. And so, you know, this is kind of like what John Bedini said, I think it was Peter Lindemann, once you switch over to regenerating your batteries rather than recharging them, you can never go back to the old ways of doing, the conventional ways of doing things. You have to continue to use this new method of, you know, radiant power system without them actually analyzing it and telling us what it is, other than that it spikes. Well, that's what I'm getting. I call it triangle waves, but they're not. They're actually spikes. So you can't have the AC grid in place, because my way of doing things competes, overwhelms, and puts it out of business, and puts it literally, it goes down. It can't function. And so I try to create systems that don't do that, that can live alongside the AC system and not disturb it. And that's what I think I've managed to do in this current juncture. I've literally modified this circuit that I've known about now for about 4 or 5 years, and so that it won't compete with the AC system that's in place. It will not steal from it. It does not get any energy from the ground. It literally gets it from the initial condition that you give it and builds off of that quickly enough. You know, at 30,000 cycles per second, it's fast enough that it's faster than the rate of thermodynamic losses due to positive impedances and resistances. So you're battling time is what you're doing. It's not a question of where do you get it from. It's a question of how quickly do you get it? Because if you create a reactance quicker than the reactive losses that will convert into real power and then thermodynamically lose themselves and dissipate themselves, then you literally get a gain over time that builds up. That's the way I see it as. You're fighting time. You create a reactance off of reactance faster than what the circuit will lose. And so you have to stay within your limits. You can't overload your circuit or else it will go comatose on you. But if you don't overload it, but usually that's not a problem, because I find that you have to take it to the load to humongous values in order to force the circuit to go comatose. And you know, if once you've got everything set up, if all you do is change the size of the load, it's really not a concern, because you're given a humongous wiggle room latitude to have all the load you like, basically, from a realistic standpoint, so that literally you can have your power station supply your needs, and there's no need to get any power from anywhere. You know, Tesla was trying to create all kinds of different, you know, wireless transmission of power. You don't even need that anymore. You create it on site wherever you need it. And literally, you could have each appliance do that for itself, although it's not a good idea, because small appliances don't need much. And to try to shrink this type of circuit down to supply only a small amount of power for like a blender or a toaster or a single light bulb doesn't work very well. It becomes very unstable. And it either wants to go comatose or explode, but it's very hard to maintain it in a strobing manner. So in order to strobe this, you have to have a lot of wiggle room. And in order to do that, you have to have elevated inductances and elevated capacitances to be able to do that. And that means you've got to deal with larger outputs of power. And so now it starts to fulfill what Eric Dollard said, is you can't do this less than a 500 kVA substation of the power grid in terms of power level. Well, I've managed to shrink it less than that, so I don't have to worry about his complaint or his warning. I can power a 100-watt light bulb, so that's not bad. And if you've got a power station that's supplying a single residence, and these days we use so much power by comparison to 100 years ago, it's okay. We can stay within that range of usage, and it won't be. We won't have to suffer instability to the system. And so every resident could have their own power station inside their home or apartment, and definitely inside the car, because the car is a humongous user of electricity. It's not efficient. It's more efficient to create a UFO, for that matter, because defying gravity or inertia would be a whole lot more energy efficient. But if we're using brute force to move the car around, you know, by rotating wheels, then sure, you want to produce 100,000 watts of power? Sure, fine, no problem. That's a lot easier, more stable than just trying to create 100 watts to power a 100-watt light bulb. That took some doing. I had to reconfigure this circuit in ways I had never dreamed of before, and still have stability. But under simulation, it's fine. It's just a question. I had the wrong calculators. I was using coil inductance calculators that I never used before, and maybe I don't know how to use them. So I was getting erroneous. I think this is what went wrong, that I got erroneously small values to my windings. You know, how many turns do I do in the dimensions? So when I went back to the coil calculator that I'm accustomed to using, it told me figures that were much higher that were required of me. You know, instead of 220 turns on the voltage coils, I have to do 10 times that. Literally, by a factor of 10, I got everything wrong. So now, I don't like winding coils, quite frankly, because it's a lot, you know, it's labor intensive. And I've got poor eyesight at the age of 66, and I lose my patience very quickly. And my hands are not steady, you know, anymore. They shake. So I have a rough time building this by hand. But needless to say, I have a little tabulator sheet. You know, I keep making a mark every time I add a layer, and I have to do 9 layers, and that's just the underbelly of this coil layering. I start with the voltage coil, I follow with the current coil, and then the load coil. So I got 3 different coils I have to put on 2 cores, and the core is a 3-pound hand weight from Walmart that is an iron, ferromagnetizable iron base covered by a spongy rubber that you hold in your hand. You know, you work your biceps and your triceps and whatever. Or you hold them while you're walking or jogging. And so I thought that would be ideal because it serves as a bobbin at the same time as having a ferromagnetizable iron core. So I had initially put 1 single layer of 220 turns of 26 gauge iron floral wire. It's insulated floral wire from Amazon, you know, very cheap. I only get about 2 or 3 layers out of it, I'm finding, and I need 9 layers total. So, and I put masking tape in between, or else it'll all bunch up. I won't get a nice, even, tight winding. So I cover each layer with Scotch tape, you know, 1-inch wide, clear plastic, 3M company, a Scotch tape, whatever. And that holds the winding, and it also creates a nice smooth surface so that I can wind on top of the prior layer. But I think the first coil, I'm only up to layer number 7. So I finished 7 layers last night. And instead of trying to do 1 layer every day, I don't even do that anymore. It takes me 3 days or more to do a single layer because I really don't like this at all. I don't like monotonous, tedious, repetitive labor. And I'm sure, you know, I've seen people tell you how to build winding machines. You just hand crank it, and it's got a little counter, and it counts every turn. Instead of me approximating, you know, I have to measure the width of the wire and then measure the length of the coil and divide. And so it's a 9 centimeter length to the coil, and it's 0.4 millimeters. So, okay, that's maybe 220 turns per 9 length centimeter with a 3 centimeter diameter, which keeps building up as I build up layers. So I've had to approximate what I'm doing, but it's a lot of winding on the voltage coil. That's the real bitch, is the voltage coil, because in order to build up, in order to create voltage, a reactance of voltage, you have to do what Joseph Newman did. You have to create a large coil of like a 20 some odd gauge number, maybe 30 at the tops at the most, of enameled wire. And in this case, it has to be iron wire because it has to be magnetizable and it has to have elevated resistances. Iron is 6 times more resistant than copper, in order to help facilitate the formation of voltage over current. And then on top of this, I'll have 2 turns of 10-gauge wire serving as the current coil, solid core copper wire to serve as the current coil. And then adjacent to that and also on top of that will be 2 layers of copper-clad aluminum 12-gauge wire that will serve as the load coil. And then I'll be done with this, and then I'll have to start on the other hand weight and finish that off. So it's going to take several weeks before I finish this winding. And so each time, you know, it fails to light up the light bulb, I think, okay, what else can I try, you know, that I haven't tried yet? And I actually hold off doing things. So I'm purposely oversimplifying my build because I'm damn lazy. And then I realize, okay, maybe I'm supposed to do it exactly the way I simulated it, and then I have to do in all these details, and, you know, it's more work, and I don't want to do the more work. It's so easy when you simulate, you just, and it's done, you know, and my God, building, it's a bitch, and I've known this. This is why, one of the reasons why I've stayed away from building, but also my paranoia of things blowing up or getting electrocuted. So I'm very careful now in going back and forth between the simulation and the real world build, and then I have to use, you know, the correct calculators to calculate inductance to make sure I get everything right, to make sure I know in advance what I'm doing so I don't get any unforeseeable surprises that I don't want to be surprised with, you know, like things blowing up. So I have a project case, I put everything in there, and I run cords into it, so my frequency generator I hold in my plastic gloved hands outside of the project case, but I have it totally sealed up so that if it should blow up, I got fuses in there in the right places so they don't get in the way of the overunity. But the 5-amp fuse, I'm really using too large, and I don't need a 5-amp fuse, but it's slightly, I have a box of fuses. I could have used a smaller one, but I'm too lazy to reconfigure the whole circuit after I went to all that trouble. I'll just keep it at the 5-amp version, which is 50 ohms. So I have a 50-ohm fuse in case it gets above 5 amps. And I have it adjacent to the light bulbs, so I don't want the light bulb to explode and shatter and put glass everywhere. I received some light bulbs from 25 watt from eBay that I ordered, and the guy didn't bother to wrap it in bubble wrap, and 2 of the 4 bulbs broke. So I got 2 out of the 4. I got half got shipped to me, and the other half turned to shards, and I had a mess on my countertop. I didn't realize I'm opening up the bag, and all these shards come out, and I'm on the floor, and I'm standing there barefoot, and oh my God, now I got a mess to clean up with broken glass. So I didn't appreciate that, but I don't want to create it either. So I have it inside a project case. It's very big plastic storage case I got from Walmart. It's 7 inches high. It's got wheels of all things. It's so big. And it's something like 1.5 feet wide and something like 3 feet long. And it's got latching handles. Oh, it's fantastic. It's really big, but I love it because I can tape all the components to the base of the inside, the interior of the case when I'm working on it. And I'm using door hinges. They're ferromagnetizable door hinges. They're not, they don't, they're, they, They're square pieces that they don't have any rotating pieces, and they only have four places for the bolts to go through. And then I got bolts and nuts and washers from Walmart. So these are my bus connections to connect everything, so I don't have to use solder. I can redo things, reconnect things, and I'm not using alligator clips or masking tape as I used 10 years ago. So everything is solid connecting. And I've seen what I want to use that I can purchase on Amazon. Once I know what I've done, what I'm doing, and want a solid connection, they're very nice. They're crimp connections or they're solder connections, and they're really cool. But I'm not at that point yet. I haven't gotten the thing to work yet, much less I want to make changes. I have to make changes. So I'm using this workaround solution that's very cheap, and it's ferromagnetizable junctions. Which is good, because it's always good to have extra inductivity, because this circuit needs so much inductance. In most places, except for the current coils, needs to be very low. So I only do two turns of that. But everything else, the inductances have to be quite high, and so I have to maximize my inductivity as much as I can wherever I can put it. And it makes it easy, to tape these junctions down to the base so that it doesn't move around, because I'm still undergoing the threat of an eviction. Nobody's told me I'm not going to be evicted. So for all intents and purposes, I could be evicted any minute and lose all my possessions, including my, anything I can't carry out and put in my car right away. I'll lose everything, but it's not a happy thought. But I keep busy to try not to think about it, because I can't save myself even if I wanted to. And I would, wouldn't I? Most people would. But I have no money to move with, no money to my trustee did admit she's willing to move me. And then so I went and looked at a place, and I realized, wait a minute, I'm lying, because I know what's going to happen. My trustee's going to dump me here, and they're going to be stuck with me not paying the rent and have to evict me all over again, or take care of this 66-year-old man and take him into their lives. And it's like, that's too much to ask of anybody, to expect them. And some of them actually ask me, why are you moving? And then, well, okay, I'll pass on that one. We don't want to go there. So that's what. So I keep busy, I have a routine. I go work Instacart and deliver groceries for a few hours, not too much, because I don't want to wear myself out. And then I come home and take a bath in borax, because I tend to get muscle cramps, so that helps ease and prevent me from cramping, because I have horrible cramps in my feet from pushing a shopping cart. I can carry, I can lift, I can go upstairs, carry heavy objects. I just can't push a heavy shopping cart without giving myself back trouble, foot trouble. Oh, it's a nightmare. So I take borax baths afterwards, and I use a couple of cups of borax. So I use a lot of borax, but it works. It literally prevents me from having foot cramps, horrible, horrible foot cramps. So that was good. I work in a little bit at a time. I wind coils at this point to see if that was my problem. Now, there may be another problem. I may be using the sine wave generator that I'm using may be too cheap. It may have too much margin of error to a perfect sine wave creation process. That it, in the process of it creating a sine wave, there may be too much error. And the error that I think would be the one that I have to worry about is consistency over time. Like, how well does it keep the same frequency over time? That probably is not a good idea if it can't do that. And then the secondary problem would be the formation of the sine wave. But I've seen my simulator create really ugly sine waves that are anything but perfect. So I don't think that's the problem. It's not a question of density of data points to create a nice smooth sine curve. I think it's consistency of frequency. Is it consistent? And Tesla said this of his special generator, and Thomas Comerford Martin wrote it down. So we know that his special generator needed a constant frequency of 80 cycles per second, and it could not vary at all. So I think consistency probably is the main key problem when feeding these circuits a sine wave? Is it a consistent frequency without any error? And what is the tolerance? Maybe there's no tolerance. Maybe I'll never be able to manifest this because the simulator is always exactly on the same frequency all the time, and the real world doesn't work that way. There's always error. So maybe this can't happen, but this car mechanic admitted that it does happen. So apparently there is a margin of error that's tolerable, maybe, that will still create this ringing of overunity. I have yet to see, obviously, me succeed in manifesting I'm just now starting. This is after 6 years of doing nothing but simulation work. This is the first time I've actually tried to build anything. So it's literally a virgin field for me that I'm still trying to get used to. You know, where are the various trap holes, you know, traps that I can fall through? You know, what do I have to focus on to get right and I can be a little more lax with everything else? I don't know. You know, I know it with a simulator, depending on which simulator I work with, it will determine what I have to focus on to get it right, to get it to work. But in the real world, I'm sure it's a different set of parameters that I have to focus on. And I don't know what those parameters are that I have to focus on. I have to find out the hard way, trial and error. So I'm finding out, maybe, or no, I'm experimenting. I'm just trying, but I haven't found out yet what I have to focus on. So that's where I'm at, basically. There's another problem in conventional wisdom that has to be corrected, and that's the idea of where does energy come from. We have to stop worrying about it. I think, from my guess estimate, from what I've been studying, it comes from the ether, ultimately. And the ether does not exist in the physical plane. It exists in counter space, like Eric Dollard says, in the realm of the square root of -1. But traditionally, if we go back in history, it does not exist in the physical plane also, but they didn't know about the relationship between a reactance and the square root of -1. So what they did was they said, well, it's operating at a higher frequency than material objects, material manifestation, but it does exist superimposed in the same space that physicality exists, but we don't see it or know about it because we can't interact with it directly because it's operating at a higher frequency than what physical matter can respond to. But I think reactance is the portal. The square root of -1, the reactance of capacitors and inductors, are the portal through which contact can be made with the ether. I think that's what happens. And so how much reactive power, if we call it that, if we choose to call it that, exists in the ether, it's not a question worthy of asking because it cannot be ascertained. There's no way to even answer the question. So it could be infinite, it could be non-deterministic, we don't know, there's no way to know. But it's from there that ultimately so-called reactive power comes from, to form real power and real objects. So when somebody, I forget the guy's name, he was a yogi, he was considered an avatar, a yogi who comes back to help humanity, not somebody who achieved the status of enlightenment, but somebody who reincarnated from having already left the field of incarnation, but elected to come back to help humanity. And when they do that, they can literally perform miracles. They can revive the dead. And in his case, he would materialize solid objects inside the palm of his hand, like a flower. He would materialize a blossom, a flower blossom, out of seemingly nowhere. Where did it come from? Well, he's pulling it from the ether, because the ether is ultimately the source of physical creation. When the physical creation gets created, it literally is utilizing the resources of the ether to do it, because the ether is the vital body that in Sanskrit is called the antakarana, the bridge between the physical and the astral. The astral is where we have sensation of pain or pleasure, even though it's not in the physical that we have this sensation, it's in the astral plane that we have the sensations. But even though the physical may cause those sensations, but the doctors have said that they've had patients have pain that they can't address because it's not coming from the physical. They say, oh, it's all in your head. No, it's coming from the astral plane is where the pain is coming from. That's why they can't address it. Well, when you go in for surgery and the general anesthesiologist gives you a general anesthetic to put you under so that they can do open heart surgery, for instance, you have to sign a release waiver in case he should, oops, slip up and give you too much general anesthetic and you die on the operating table before they even cut you open. And the reason for that is because when he gives you the general anesthetic, it pushes the etheric body, the vital life force body, out of the physical body to a large degree, so you go numb. So you won't feel the sting of the surgeon's knife when he cuts into you. And if he pushes out the vital body out of the physical body too much, you know, it's a percentage thing. It's a statistical thing. If he only pushes out 99% and he can manage to get away with it, you stay alive, you're just not conscious, and you don't feel anything until you wake up. Then maybe you feel something. But so long as you're under the dosage, you don't feel anything, you're out, you're knocked out, you're asleep. But if he pushes your vital body too much, you die. Because the bridge then between the physical and the astral has been broken. And when the corpse is in the cemetery decomposing, the vital body is also slowly dissipating, but is waiting for the physical body to decompose in order for the vital body to dissipate. Now, if the physical body is cremated, the vital body dissipates immediately. But if you pray to that ghost, and enough people do it, talk about where does the energy come from. Now we are feeding that vital body energy, our vital force, by our attention span. We're putting our attention on it and we keep it alive. And this is why people had visions of Mother Mary at Fatima, Italy, many years ago, these young children, because everybody prays to Mother Mary and they keep the ghost of Mother Mary alive for these last 2,000 years, so long as we keep praying to it. And I have got this movie in my collection called Merlin with Sam Neill in it and Helena Bonham Carter and Martin Short, all these big wig actors. And this gal is playing, I forget her name, she's a force of nature. She's a goddess of nature. There's the Lady of the Lake is her sister, but she's this evil girl who's going to get her way no matter what. And in the end of the movie, everybody turns their back on her. Merlin turns his back on her, and they all walk away and forget about her, and she literally disappears because people stop thinking about her. So this is an interesting feature when you ask, where does the energy come from? Yeah, it originally originates from the ether, but it also recirculates within the physical plane. So that when we eat food, for instance, especially if it's raw food, then we're eating the life force of that creature, whether it's a plant or an animal, we're consuming the life force of that creature. So in that sense, we're recirculating the life force that's already manifest, that's already associated with physical matter, while it's still associated with it. Because if we cook it and destroy it sufficiently enough, it'll lose its association with it, the life force that used to keep it alive, and we won't be getting any life force. We will be getting the calories that's stored there, that's true. The calories may still be there, but I suppose the life force is still associated with it. If we haven't turned it to carbon ash or mineral ash, then the life force is totally dissipated at that point, and we won't get any value from it except mineral ash, the mineral value. So, yeah, there is always an etheric body associated with physical matter, even objects. They have it, although I've never seen it myself. When I was younger, I had the ability to see the light body of plants and of animals and people. And I never saw it of physical objects, but I can't assume it's not there. In fact, I have to assume that it is there because all objects create vibratory on the subtle plane, vibratory phenomenon that can be heard. And I heard wheatgrass plants singing, and I saw them emit light and emotion and meaning, and they were dancing in a very meaningful manner, in a creative manner. And then I used that, I was 19 at the time, as a starting point to look at the, to vaguely sense the entirety of my environment was actually doing the same thing. So whether it strictly comes from living creatures or whether it also comes from solid objects, I suspect it comes from everything, basically. That was my perception. The music of the spheres is the entirety of creation creating vibratory self-expression that is self-intelligent. It's self-expression. It's all, in other words, all objects are alive. There's no such thing as a dead object. It's just the consciousness is, relativistically speaking, so dead, it appears to be dead by our standards of what constitutes being alive, but it's impossible for it to be totally dead or else it would not exist. It's a good question you ask. Where does it come from? So that's one option, is the recirculation of what is already has been made manifest. But it doesn't mean you have to, strictly speaking, get it from the recirculation of energy. You can go directly to the source, which is the etheric plane. And Eric Dollard gives the best rendition of what that might be. Because we don't know what it is. We can infer what it might be using the square root of negative one, but that doesn't tell us anything because you can't create a demonstration in the physical plane of what the square root of negative one is anyway. So all we're doing is we're alluding to, we're inferring something that we cannot directly access and say, oh, and prove, oh, that's where it's coming from. All we can do is say, well, you know, that seems to be where it's coming from, but since we can't prove its existence with real numbers, with real measurements of real numbers, we can't really say where it's coming from. But mathematics will hint at the fact that, oh, you know, it looks like it's coming from the plane of the imaginary number. Not complex numbers, because that's a mixture of the imaginary source and the real recirculation. The recirculating real power and combined with the imaginary ultimate source of purely imaginary numbers, that complex number that electrical engineers are taught to deal with is really a mixture of the original source and the recirculation. So to answer your question, it comes from two sources. We either get it from what already exists, but to some degree, but we will also be getting it directly from the source, which is beyond physicality. It's within, purely within the realm of pure imaginary numbers, which we cannot prove. We just say, hey, you know, the math works. Over a century of imaginary numbers, the math works, but it still doesn't tell us where that something is. Well, it's right in front of our faces, but we can't vibrate fast enough to see it, to feel it, to touch it. And I suspect the etheric plane is amorphous. There's no structure per se. That's probably why we have the physical plane, to give us structure, to structure our energy into solid objects. But when we go to the etheric plane, it becomes destructured. Now, when we go to the astral plane, we can go back to structures again. So, as far as I know, as far as I can infer, the even-numbered planes of existence associated with the major chakras of the seven chakra system, of looking at the stratosphere of creation, how it stratifies itself, the even-numbered chakras, counting from the bottom up, may be amorphous without structure. They have qualities, to the plane of existence, you know, like the intuitive plane, the third eye chakra, the sixth chakra, is this networking in which you can't really pin down where did you get the information from. All you know is you got it from some living creature that exists somewhere in creation now, or maybe in the past or in the future, because time really doesn't have much meaning anymore because it's a timeless plane of existence. So I think the even-numbered chakras are amorphous. Or excuse me, the even-numbered planes of existence, such as the ether, are amorphous, while the odd ones, 1, 3, 5, and 7, those planes of existence, which includes the physical plane, which is the first chakra, the Muladhara chakra, the physical plane, is structured at the cost of its energy. It gets converted into structure, and because of that, we get functionality out of that structure. We won't get it out of amorphous energy. You won't get function out of amorphous energy. You've got amplitudes, raw amplitudes of energy to work with, but you can't do anything with it. It's only when you get into the structured planes you can do something with it by creating functionality out of that. And then we get our mass, you know, plus, minus, divide, we get our structure, our structured functionality when we deal with math. Well, that's the structured plane of the physical plane that we use our mathematics. But square root of negative one is a structure of a sort, but it's you can't do anything with it, right? So because you can't do anything with it, it just sits there in your equation, surrounded by everything else that's not the square root of negative one. And then you can add, subtract, multiply, divide, and, you know, do all your stuff to it because you're working with other things. And so that's why electrical engineers are taught to deal with complex numbers, not purely imaginary numbers, because you can't do anything with purely imaginary numbers. You have to have a mixture of real numbers and imaginary numbers to be able to do anything mathematically speaking, you know, plus, minus, and divide, to have an equation. So I think that's what the etheric plane is. That's where it's located. And that's why we can't find it. We can't prove its existence because it's not in the physical plane. And yet it's a neighbor. It's our immediate neighbor to the physical plane, supplying us with all the vital force that we need to keep animals and plants alive and keep them well and happy. But if we don't go there, then we recirculate what we already possess. So when I walk barefoot on the grass, I'm getting the life force from the earth. When I sleep connected by a single wire to the earth on my earthing bed, I'm getting the life force from the earth. You won't find science talking about it. Maybe Curly and photography can go there, maybe, you know. But that's a result. That doesn't tell you about causes. That just shows you the effect, what effect the life force has on physical objects when you take pictures of it a certain way. Okay, that's nice. But, you know, scientists want to understand, and so it doesn't tell them what they want to know. It just demonstrates the presence of something they can't explain, basically.